Okay, more open lines to go when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Let's go straight to the phones. Wildcard line, you're up with us. Hi there.
Good morning, George. Hey. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Yes, I would like to offer an alternative explanation having to do with chemtrails.
Okay, sure.
Usually the explanation that we hear is that they're spraying chemicals either to our biologicals to affect the weather, people, animals, or plants.
Correct.
Or crops on the ground.
Right.
I would suggest that there are four different types of things in space, either in low Earth orbit or that might be either scanning or entering the Earth's atmosphere from space, that might explain chemtrails. Those four things are spy satellites, low Earth orbit spy planes such as the Aurora or the Blackbird, space-based weapon systems of either laser, plasma, or EMP weapons, and last, most speculative of all, would be UFOs or stealth aircraft. Spy satellites and spy planes monitor a broad spectrum of emissions from the ground, such as natural light or visible photography, heat signatures, spectral signatures, chemical signatures, looking for different types of activities. Same with low Earth orbit spy planes. Particleized clouds that are sprayed either in low Earth orbit or into the lower Earth's atmosphere might hide or make it more difficult to detect certain activities that are on the ground that you want to hide from low Earth orbit spy planes or from satellites. Hmm. And also, these particleized clouds might be a possible way to disrupt space-based weapons aimed at the ground, such as plasma or especially EMP weapons. Metal particles might disrupt that or cause it to be somewhat shielded and mitigated. The last thing, if you have a UFO or some sort of stealth craft that you cannot detect either visibly or on radar, if you have a cloud in low Earth orbit, or you are in the Earth's atmosphere,
right,
you might not be able to see the thing, but you can detect its trail through the cloud.
Interesting.
Possible explanations,
yeah,
for what may be going on. They may be trying to figure out a way to spray a cloud of particles to protect certain areas from space-based weapons.
Gosh, they'd have to spray a lot, though, wouldn't they?
Not necessarily. I worked as a radio technician for 30-something years, and we used to, in some places where there was a lot of radio interference, we would have what were called screen rooms, which would consist of a wire mesh of a certain length to the mesh that would, help us to work on radio equipment inside that room without getting interference from other, you know, nearby transmitters and stuff. And the same thing, metalized particles might very well disrupt or mitigate an EMP pulse enough to where it might protect your computers on the ground or certain other, you know, sensitive installations that could be affected by an EMP pulse coming from space, or a laser weapon might be deflected are in some way diffused enough, or a pulse or a plasma weapon, it might heat up the cloud instead of heating up the ground.
Great, I gotta tell you, great theories. I would have wished you would have called when I had William Thomas on.
So these are just some thoughts that I had about these chemtrails and what the government might be doing. I'm sure they probably are experimenting with weather modification.
Yeah, there's no doubt on that, too.
But some of these other things may have to do with defensive measures. Also, it may these metal particles may be there to absorb heat from something else, like a HAARP weapon, you know, or something like that.
All right. Well, good. Those are interesting theories, and I've never heard any of them before. Let's go to East of the Rockies. You're up with us. Hello there.
Hello, George. How are you doing this
morning? I'm doing okay.
Wonderful. My story is this. I'll make it real quick as possible, and I'm very skeptic about a lot of things I hear, but it's very entertaining for me to listen to it. And my whole life, I've kind of been very skeptic until the last past weekend. I've been going to the same fishing spot in Lake Erie for about the last 15 years.
All right.
My brother and I was on our boat, and we was out fishing for walleye, and I kept on hearing this buzzing noise. And I'm very used to some of the, I guess, the insect life, marine life in the area. I'm familiar with it. And I know dragonflies, what they look like. And it's this buzzing sound. My brother and I are looking around, and I noticed this insect, which we thought was an insect, about 6 inches long, with kind of like a metallic color, making a buzz noise, and it landed on the very end of our boat. And we're both looking at it just in total awe.
Yeah.
And it blinks its eyes almost robotic. The eyes blink. And then, now, here's the thing. And so we're both like, no, okay, you know, this can't be happening. So as we go over to it, it takes off very quick, and it looks like it's starting to lose control, and it hits the side of a railroad bridge, which we fish under Lake Erie. And as it hits, a puff of smoke comes up. So we immediately go over to it, and as we go over to it, we find nothing but a little thing of like a liquid, almost if you would think of an insect with blood in it, but it was not blood. It was a kind of a purplish-looking color, almost maybe some type of like a hydraulic fluid or something of that nature. Well, we don't think after that. We're looking around for it, cannot find it. So we continue our day fishing, and the whole time we're talking about it. Well, this was early around, I'm going to say 6:30 in the morning, so around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm taking my boat back up. My brother's getting the truck to bring it down to load it up. We look over, which is about maybe a quarter mile off. There's four. Now, mind you, George, we're the only one in the area fishing at that time. Four U.S. Coast Guard boats are in that area.
What? You know, this is weird because last week we got a call of someone who picked up a little thing like this, put it in a can, and then somebody broke into his house and stole it.
Okay, that's what I was going to tell you. Now, my brother, I've only been listening to the show for last few days, actually, because my brother has been a long-time listener to you, but I just had to call him. He said that he heard the story about some guy maybe that he said maybe an agent or someone came in his house or something.
Broke in.
Yeah, and he was telling, I was like, oh, come on, you know. And I like to say, I mean, I was very skeptical to a lot of things, and I never was a listener to it, but I mean, and I know you may get a lot of calls, and some people we can't, you know, I won't judge anybody from what they say, but this really, honest to God, this really happened, and it gave me cold chills where it almost froze my whole body after I seen the Coast Guard there.
Where is this thing?
This was in Lake Erie. This was off of Sandusky, close to the Cedar Point area.
I mean, where's this little contraption?
Oh, I don't know. That's what I'm saying. Well, it hit, and that was it. So we went over and looked for it. Could not find it in the water. I just seen the little purple look.
Okay, so you just saw the remnants of whatever it left behind.
And left a puff of smoke. We went over to it and checked it out. Could not find it nowhere. We left about, like I said, it's about 6:30 in the morning. So around 3 o'clock when we're getting in our truck, my brother's blowing the truck down. I just happened to look back over there, and we're looking, and he's like, oh, my God. And sure enough, there's three U.S. Coast Guard boats. We did not call nothing in. We did not tell no one about it. But three Coast Guard boats are right at that spot. And we didn't see divers. I don't know if people dove in or what. But we've seen three boats in that same area against the wall there.
I think it's a little spy drone. That's exactly what it is. And it's shaped like a dragonfly. And they were out playing around with it. And something happened to it. I mean, you do know they've got them as small as flies now with little cameras on them. Let's go to our next first-time caller line. We only have one. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, is this me?
Are you on the first-time caller line?
I think I am.
Then that is you.
Okay. I'm calling from Santa Rosa in California.
Yeah.
And a few years ago, some of the ladies at work took me out to lunch for my birthday.
That was nice of them.
One of the women was late, and she was walking on the opposite side of the street from what she usually walks on, and she found on the ground a perfect long-stemmed yellow rose with the dewdrop still on it, and she thought, well, I'll give this to her. So she brings it in, and she says, this is for you, and I said, well, oh, that's so pretty. Why don't you keep it, you know, as a gift? And she said, no, I just feel like this is for you. Well, she didn't know this, but I have a daughter who was in a car crash when she was 21.
Okay.
And I'm nervous. That was her favorite flower. And everybody said, this is from your daughter. And then, sometime after that, I took an art class for the first time in 20 years. And there was a model, and she was a young woman like my daughter when she was 21. And she set up her little scene there, and there was a long-stemmed yellow rose right there.
How about that?
And so, she just reminded me of my daughter, who was my best friend.
These things work in strange ways, don't they?
Yeah, it was beautiful.
They really do. Hey, great. Thanks for the story.
Thank you.
All right, West of the Rockies, your turn. Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
Is that me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, George, I talked to you a couple months ago when you done the Jim Morrison thing.
Oh, yeah.
I have a whole bunch of CDs here for you. I just got to figure out where to send them, but that's neither here nor there. But I did want to ask you about a couple authors you've talked about.
If I can help you, if I remember.
Jerry Pournelle and Larry Niven.
Yes, good guys.
I wanted to ask you, what characters did they portray in, the personas, the whatever they...
Well, they read a lot of science fiction, and on one of their better books, or they're all good. I know Jerry listens to the show every night, is Lucifer's Hammer.
And, I bought that book 7 times.
Isn't it fun? 7 times? For people or for yourself?
Well, no, I buy them. And I loan them to people, and they never come back. and I do read it about every 2 or 3 years.
It's great,
but it's
great.
A fantastic book, and yeah. So is football.
We've had them on the air. Maybe it's time to get them both back on again. I know Jerry's been fighting some health situations, but he's getting better.
But I was just curious. I mean, are there personalities in any of these characters?
Their personal books? Personalities?
Yeah, I was thinking like.
I never thought of that.
That Mark Chestu, he was the biker, or Harry Reddington in football.
It's not Pournelle, and it's not Niven.
Well, that part of the book where,
I'll get them on. I'll tell you what, we'll do that. You sounds like you love their work, and that'd be a neat night. They're great, great science fiction writers. And Jerry also is a great science writer. As a matter of fact, and has given me some great stories over the last couple of years. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hello, George. This is me. My other name is John from New York.
John, welcome to the show. Good.
I got two topics that I wanted to jump on real quick, but a gentleman called the last hour, and if I can squeeze that in. Good luck to me.
Good luck to you. Let's take your best shot first.
Okay, here we go. A few months ago, I talked to you about, I'm from New York, state of New York, and a prediction I made to you came true. The cigarette tax and how up until June 3rd, the previous year, up until June 3rd, in other words, June 3rd of 06, oh, I'm sorry, 07 to 08.
Right.
They were giving away most, you would walk into a store and get a free pack of cigarettes if you bought one. And as an ex-smoker since June 3rd, because I will not give New York State my taxes, I noticed, and I predicted it way back when, that when June 3rd hits, there's not going to be another buy one, get one free. And I've been looking around as I go into each and every store.
Are they still doing it?
No, they're not. That's the whole point. That's the point. The whole year before, they were getting the addicted, re-addicted, and they were getting the 16 and 17-year-olds.
Uh-huh.
In my opinion.
You might be right.
They were thinking, well, this isn't so expensive.
And once we get them, let's stop.
Yeah, they got them. It takes, how long does it take to get addicted? And another thing, a shout out to anyone from New York to verify that, please do. But I had a conversation with a bank today, and I won't say what bank, and I will not say specifically what it was about, but it was about hidden fees. And I would love to send you a tape, because I did tape the conversation, and it is astonishing. These banks, they make billions. Do you ever hear of Bob Sullivan?
No.
Bob Sullivan is on MSNBC. I haven't ever seen him. I just read his book. He's too early in the morning for me.
So. Probably me too.
Exactly. But he's on twice a week, and plus he has a website called The Red Tape, not Diaries, Red Tape something. But how about, you know, cell phone, hidden fees everywhere.
Oh, absolutely. They make millions and billions. You're right. You're right. They all make money on hidden fees. And, you know, you look at your bill, you'll see these things. They make a small fortune. Let's go to our Hope Line. We have about 2 minutes for you. You're on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
This is my first time through in 2 years, and I love your show. I'm
glad you made it.
Thank you. I just wanted to briefly share an experience I had about 6 months after my father passed away.
Sure.
I had just drifted off to sleep one night, and my dad came to me, and he said he needed to share something with me, and he could only come to me just once. And he took me to another place, another realm, which seemed to be a place of transition. And he said he had something fabulous to show me, and he called it the Eye of God. I'm not sure why that name, but it was very strange. But he, a portal was kind of opened, and it divulged this really boundless kingdom, is what I could call it, of just brilliant, brilliant light. And it was just an all-consuming light that my body just started resonating with the energy of it.
Was it like heaven?
Yeah, it was a lot. Well, what I would picture heaven to be like. Because it was such an overwhelming feeling of love, and it was like my body was resonating with some sort of energy there, and it was just merging with this light, and it was as if there was no time. Time was suspended, and this love was just engulfing me. It was just part of me, and I was part of it.
And what did you bring back because of this experience?
Well, I think the reason my dad did this is because I had had a fear of death for a long time, and he knew that. And even though I have a strong faith, I still had this fear of the unknown, I think, more than anything. And since then, I haven't feared it. That fear is gone. And it was like, wow. I mean, it was an amazing experience, and it was so real. And my dad was young. He was 30, and he was so happy, and he was just literally glowing. And
they always pick that young year, don't they?
Yeah, he was about 30.
I think I just keep the same year I have. I would. Hey, we got to take this move. We're going to move into this break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about an inexperienced ghost. So we'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, what do you do when you come across an inexperienced ghost? Think about that for a moment.
The Story of the Inexperienced Ghost by H.G. Wells. The scene amidst which Clayton told his last story comes back very vividly to my mind. There he sat for the greater part of the time by the spacious open fire, and Sanderson sat beside him smoking the Broseley clay that bore his name. There was Evans, and that marvel among actors, Wish, who is also a modest man. We had all come down to the Mermaid Club that Saturday morning, except Clayton, who had slept there overnight, which indeed gave him the opening of his story. We had golfed until golfing was invisible. We had dined, and we were in that mood of tranquil kindliness when men will suffer a story. When Clayton began to tell one, we naturally supposed he was lying. It may be that indeed he was lying. Of that the reader will speedily be able to judge as well as I. I say he remarked after a long consideration of the upward rain of sparks from the log that Sanderson had thumped. You know I was alone here last night. Except for the domestics, said Wish. Who's sleeping the other wing, said Clayton. Yes, well, he pulled at his cigar for some little time as though he still hesitated about his confidence. Then he said, quite quietly, I caught a ghost. Caught a ghost, did you? Said Sanderson. Where is it? And Evans, who admires Clayton immensely, shouted, caught a ghost, did you, Clayton? I'm glad of it. Tell us all about it right now. Clayton said he would in a minute and asked him to shut the door. We don't want to upset our very excellent service with any rumors of ghosts in this place. And this, you know, wasn't a regular ghost. I don't think it will ever come again, ever. You mean to say you didn't keep it, said Sanderson. I hadn't the heart to, said Clayton. And Sanderson said he was surprised. We laughed and Clayton looked aggrieved. I know, he said, with a flicker of a smile, but the fact is it really was a ghost. And I'm as sure of it as I am that I am talking to you now. I'm not joking. I mean what I say. It is the strangest thing that has ever happened in my life. You know, I never believed in ghosts or anything of that sort before, ever. And then, you know, I bag one in a corner, and the whole business is in my hands. You talk to it? Asked Wish. For the space, probably, of an hour. Chatty, I said, joining the party of the skeptics. The poor devil was in trouble, said Clayton. Sobbing, someone asked. Clayton heaved a realistic sigh at the memory. Poor fellow, yes. Where did you strike it? Asked Evans. I never realized, said Clayton, ignoring him, the poor sort of a thing a ghost might be. I took an advantage, he reflected at last. We were none of us in a hurry. A character, he said, remains just the same character for all that it's been disembodied. That's a thing we too often forget. People with a certain strength or fixity of purpose may have ghosts of a certain strength and fixity of purpose. I came upon him, you know, in the long passage. His back was towards me, and I saw him first. Right off, I knew him for a ghost. He was transparent and whitish, clean through his chest, and I could see the glimmer of the little window at the end. And not only his physique, but his attitude struck me as being weak. He looked, you know, as though he didn't know in the slightest whatever he meant to do. What sort of physique? Said Sanderson. Lean, shoulders bad, nearer than the hips, turned-down collar, ready-made short jacket, trousers baggy, and a little frayed at the heels. I came very quietly up the staircase. I did not carry a light, you know, and I saw him as I came up. I stopped dead at that, taking him in. I wasn't a bit afraid. I think that in most of these affairs, one is never nearly so afraid or excited as one imagines one would be. I was surprised and interested. I thought, good Lord, here's a ghost at last. And I haven't believed for a moment in ghosts during the last 25 years. Said Wish. I suppose I wasn't on the landing a moment before he found out I was there. He turned on me sharply, and I saw the face of an immature young man, a weak nose, a scrubby little mustache, a feeble chin. So for an instant we stood. Then he seemed to remember his high calling. He turned round, drew himself up, projected his face, raised his arms, spread his hands in approved ghost fashion, came towards me. As he did so, his little jaw dropped, and he emitted a faint, drawn-out boo. No, it wasn't. Not a bit dreadful. I had a bottle of champagne, and being all alone, perhaps two or three, perhaps even four or five whiskies. So I was as solid as rocks and no more frightened than if I'd been assailed by a frog. Boo, I said. Nonsense. You don't belong to this place. What are you doing here? I could see him wince. Boo, he said. Boo, be hanged. Are you a member? I said, and just to show I didn't care a pin for him, I stepped through a corner of him and made to light my candle. Are you a member? I repeated, looking at him sideways. He moved a little so as to stand clear of me, and his bearing became crestfallen. No, he said. In an answer to the persistent interrogation of my eye, I'm not a member. I'm a ghost. Well, that doesn't give you the run of the Mermaid Club. What are you doing here? I said. He had dropped his hands and stopped his booing, and there he stood, abashed and awkward, the ghost of a weak, silly, aimless young man. I'm haunting, he said. You haven't any business to, I said in a quiet voice. I'm a ghost, he said, as if in defense. That may be, but you haven't any business to haunt here. This is a respectable private club. People often stop here with nursemaids and children, and going about in the careless way you do, some poor little mite could easily come upon you and be scared out of her wits. I suppose you didn't think of that. No, sir, he said, I didn't. You should have done. You haven't any claim on the place, have you? Weren't murdered here, or anything of that sort. None, sir, but I thought as it was old and oak-paneled. That's no excuse, I regarded him firmly. Your coming here is a mistake. I said, if I were you, I'd vanish right away. He looked embarrassed. The fact is, sir, that somehow I can't. You can't?
No, sir, there's something I've forgotten. I've been hanging around here since midnight last night, hiding in the cupboards of the empty bedrooms and things like that. I've never come haunting before, and it seems to put me out.
Put you out?
Yes, sir. I've tried to do it several times, and it doesn't come off. There's some little thing has slipped me, and I can't get back. That, you know, rather bowled me over. Come into my room and tell me more about it, I said. I didn't, of course, understand this, and I tried to take him by the arm. But, of course, you might as well have tried to take hold of a puff of smoke. I had forgotten my number. I think, anyhow, I remember going into several bedrooms. It was lucky. I was the only soul in that wing until I saw my traps. Here we are, I said, and sat down in the armchair. Sit down and tell me all about it. It seems to me you have got yourself into a jolly awkward position, old chap. He was telling me all about this wretched little life of his that had recently ended on Earth. He hadn't a particularly honest face, you know, but being transparent, of course, he couldn't avoid telling the truth. Eh? Said Wish, suddenly sitting up in his chair. What? Said Clayton. Being transparent couldn't avoid telling the truth. I don't see it, said Wish. I don't see it, said Clayton, but it is so, I can assure you, nevertheless. He told me how he had been killed. He went down into a London basement with a candle to look for a leakage of gas and described himself as a senior English master in a London private school when the release occurred. Poor wretch, I said. That's what I thought, and the more he talked, the more I thought. There he was, purposeless in life and purposeless out of it. He talked of his father and his mother and his schoolmaster and all who had ever been anything to him in the world meanly. He had been too sensitive, too nervous. None of them had ever valued him properly or understood him. He had never had a real friend in the world. I think he had never had a success. Engaged to be married, of course, to another oversensitive person, I suppose, when the indiscretion with the gas escape ended his affairs. And where are you now, I asked, not in... He wasn't clear on that point at all. The impression he gave me was sort of a vague intermediate state, a special reserve for souls too non-existent for anything, so positive as either sin or virtue, I don't know. He was much too egotistical and unobservant to give me any clear idea of the kind of place, kind of country there is on the other side of things. Wherever he was, he seems to have fallen in with a set of kindred spirits, and among those there was certainly a lot of talk about going hunting and things like that. Yes, going hunting. They seemed to think hunting a tremendous adventure, and most of them flunked it all the time. And so primed, you know, he had come. But really, said Wish to the fire, he was thinner and sillier and more pointless than if he had been real and alive. Only then, you know, he would not have been in my bedroom here if he had been alive. I should have kicked him out. Of course, said Evans, there are poor mortals like that. And there's just as much chance of their having ghosts as the rest of us, I admitted. The mess that he had made of haunting had depressed him terribly. He had been told it would be a lark. He had come expecting it to be a lark, and here it was. Nothing but another failure added to his record. He proclaimed himself an utter out-and-out failure. He said, and I can quite believe it, that he had never tried to do anything all of his life that he hadn't made a perfect mess of, and through all the wastes of eternity, he never would. He remarked that, strange as it might seem to me, nobody, not anyone ever, had given him the amount of sympathy I was doing now. I could see what he wanted straight away, and I determined to head him off at once. I may be a brute, you know, but being the only real friend, the recipient of the confidences of one of those egotistical weaklings, ghost or body, is beyond my physical endurance. I got up briskly. Don't you brood on these things too much, I said. The thing you've got to do is to get out of this. Get out of this sharp. You pull yourself together and try. I can't, he said. You try, I said, and try he did. Try, said Sanderson. How? Passes, said Clayton. Passes? Complicated series of gestures and passes with the hands. That's how he had come in, and that's how he had to get out again. Lord, what a business I had. But how could any series of passes, I began. My dear man, said Clayton, you want everything clear. I don't know how. All I know is that you do, that he did, anyhow, at least. After a fearful time, you know, he got his passes right and suddenly disappeared. Did you, said Sanderson slowly, observe the passes? Yes, said Clayton, there we were. I and this thin, vague ghost in that silent room in this silent, empty inn in this silent little Friday night town. Not a sound except our voices and a faint panting he made when he swung. And suddenly he sat down on a little chair at the foot of the bed and began to sob and sob. "You pull yourself together," I said, and tried to pat him on the back, and my confounded hand went through him. I remember snatching back my hand out of him, as it were, with a little thrill, and walking over to the dressing table. "You pull yourself together," I said to him, "and try." And in order to encourage and help him, I began to try as well. "What?" said Sanderson. "The passes?" "Yes, the passes." "This is interesting," said Sanderson, with his finger in his pipe bowl. "You mean to say this ghost of yours gave away, did his level best to give away the whole confounded barrier?" "Yes." "He didn't," said Wish. "He couldn't, or you'd have gone there too." "That is precisely it," said Clayton. For just a little while there was silence. "And at last he did it?" said Sanderson. "At last he did it." Then he said peevishly, "I can't do it if you look at me. I really can't." "All right," I said. "I won't look at you," and turned towards the mirror on the wardrobe by the bed. I was alone with the flaring candles and a staggering mind. What had happened? Had anything happened? Had I been dreaming? "And then you went to bed?" asked Evans. "What else was there to do?" "And about these passes," said Sanderson, "I believe I could do them now." "And that's what I'm going to do," said Clayton. "They won't work," said Evans. "If they do," I suggested. "You know, I'd rather you didn't," said Wish, stretching out his legs. "Why?" asked Evans. "I'd rather he didn't," said Wish. "Clayton," said I, "you're too good a liar for us. Most of it was all right, but that disappearance happened to be convincing. Tell us, it's a tale of cock and bull. You really do, you know, put things together, Clayton, in a most amazing fashion," said Sanderson. "But there's one little detail out." "I know," said Clayton. "I believe I could tell you which." "Well?" "This," said Clayton, and did a queer little twist and writhing and thrust of the hands. "Yes?" "That, you know, was what he couldn't get right," said Clayton. He stood up before the waning fire and smiled at us all. But I think there was just a little hesitation in his smile. "If I begin," he said. "I wouldn't begin," said Wish. "It's all right," said Evans. "Matter is indestructible. You don't think any jiggery, pokery of this sort is going to snatch Clayton into the world of shades? Not it. You may try, Clayton, so far as I'm concerned, until your arms drop off at the wrists." "I don't believe that," said Wish, and stood up and put his arm on Clayton's shoulder. "You've made me half believe in that story somehow, and I don't want to see the thing done." "Goodness," said I, "here's Wish, frightened." "I am," said Wish. "I believe that if he goes through these motions right, he'll go." "He'll not do anything of this sort," I cried, "and there's only one way out of this world for men, and Clayton is 30 years from that. Besides, and such a ghost, do you think?" Wish interrupted me by moving. "Clayton," he said, "you're a fool." Clayton smiled back at him. "Wish," he said, "is right, and all you others are wrong. I shall go. I shall get to the end of these passes, and as the last swish whistles through the air, presto, this hearth rug will be vacant. The room will be blank amazement, and a respectably dressed gentleman of 15 stone will plump into the world of shades. I'm certain, so will you be. I decline to argue further. Let the thing be tried." "No," said Wish, and made a step and ceased, and Clayton raised his hands once more to repeat the spirit's passing. By that time, you know, we were all in a state of tension, largely because of the behavior of Wish. We sat, all of us, with our eyes on Clayton, I, at least, with a sort of tight, stiff feeling about me, as though from the back of my skull to the middle of my thighs, my body had been changed to steel. And there, with a gravity that was imperturbably serene, Clayton bowed and swayed, waved his hands and arms before us. As he drew towards the end, one piled up, one tingled in one's teeth. The last gesture, I have said, was to swing the arms out wide open, with the face held up. And when at last he swung out to this closing gesture, I ceased even to breathe. It was ridiculous, of course, but you know that ghost story feeling? It was after dinner, in a queer old shadowy house. Would he, after all? There he stood for one stupendous moment, with his arms open and his upturned face, assured and bright in the glare of the hanging lamp. We hung through that moment as if it were an age, and then came from all of us something that was half a sigh of infinite relief and half a reassuring no, for visibly He wasn't going. It was all nonsense. And he had told an idle story and carried it almost to conviction. That was all. And then, in that moment, the face of Clayton changed. It changed. It changed as a lit house changes when its lights are suddenly extinguished. His eyes were suddenly eyes that were fixed. His smile was frozen on his lips, and he stood there, still. He stood there, very gently swaying. That moment, too, was an age. And then, you know, chairs were scraping, things were falling, and we were all moving. His knees seemed to give, and he fell forward, and Evans rose and caught him in his arms. It stunned us all. For a minute, I suppose, no one said a coherent thing. We believed it, yet could not believe it. I came out of a muddled stupefaction to find myself kneeling beside him, and his vest and shirt were torn open, and Sanderson's hand lay on his heart. Well, the simple fact before us could very well wait our convenience. There was no hurry for us to comprehend. It lay there for an hour, black and amazing still to this day. Clayton had indeed passed into the world that lies so near to and so far from our own. He had gone thither by the only road that mortal man may take. But whether he did indeed pass there by that poor ghost's incantation, or whether he was stricken suddenly in the mists of an idle tale, as the coroner's jury would have us believe, is no matter for my judging. It is just one of those inexplicable riddles that must remain unsolved until the final solution of all things shall come. All I certainly know is that in the very moment, in the very instant of concluding those passes, he changed and staggered and fell down before us dead.
For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Gina Salvati, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. Until then, be safe, everyone.